I remember this day very distinctly. It was one of the most transformative days of my life. I was walking down the street, blue skies, sun was out, perfect weather. Everything in my life was going amazing. And I remember walking down the street and seeing these two attractive young women walking in front of me. I had this experience of just strong, intense craving and desire to be with them. It felt like a black hole had opened up inside of me. It was this pit in my stomach that said, unless you have them, you won't be happy. And it was in that moment that I realized that this state of lust, it was a state of suffering. It was a state of emptiness, a state of lack, because I was looking at what I didn't have rather than all the things I was happy with.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefield. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction, and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery, or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Today we have a great guest, Jeremy Lichowitz, a former Buddhist monk. Jeremy is a meditation teacher and a coach who helps high-achieving men break free from compulsive behaviors, especially porn addiction, and builds back their lives with integrity, discipline, and deep fulfillment. He spoke to us from Thailand, but he is originally from San Francisco in California. He talks about why pleasure is not the same as happiness. He advises how you might be able to take back your power to choose and the silent taboos that don't have to lead to destruction. Thanks, Jeremy, for coming on. This is powerful. I know you're busy. I know you have an incredible podcast and you're coaching and you work in men's groups and you do lots and lots of stuff. I think we have quite a few similarities, except for I live in dull weather and you live in wonderful sunny heat.
Yeah, Thailand is it's a different place out here, but I love it.
Jeremy, I'd love for my audience if we can walk through your story. Where are you originally from? What kind of upbringing did you have?
So I'm originally from California, from the Bay Area. Well, I was born just near San Francisco in a place called Daly City. My parents got divorced when I was three, ended up moving to Santa Cruz around age of six, but spent most of my life in the Bay Area. Ended up going to university at the University of California, Davis, and then hopped over to the East Coast for grad school at Duke University.
And what did you do? Were you a sports guy? Were you a quiet guy? Were you a shy guy?
Yeah, I've always been more of a quiet, a bit introverted, but also sporty. So, you know, I got into all kinds of sports when I was in high school. And then when I got to college, I started getting into things like Muay Thai and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and some of the martial arts. And that was a huge part of my life. I did Muay Thai for about 3 years. Starting in high school. And then when I got to college, I transitioned to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And that was a big part of my identity. So I was really into fitness, really into sports and health. I mean, part of that, as we'll maybe talk about later, was a little bit of this addictive nature of wanting, you know, pleasure, wanting to be liked, wanting to look good. You know, part of my history with porn addiction is also related to things like body dysmorphia and, you know, wanting everything to be perfect.
Do you think that the divorce from your parents had affected you as well with your self-esteem?
I'm sure it had an impact. You know, it wasn't something, I think it affected my sisters a bit more. For me, I'm sure it had an impact and impacted my ability to get my needs met and get attention and get, you know, love in a divorced home where my parents were not friendly with each other. It was not kind of an amicable break. I didn't have one big capital T trauma. I had a lot of these smaller lowercase t traumas of just being teased or bullied at school, being left alone to raise myself. So all of these little ways that I wasn't getting my needs met, I think, had an impact on me. Well, there are so many guys out there and women as well, but I mostly work with men, feel like they don't deserve whatever trauma they're going through, whatever unhealthy coping mechanisms, because they haven't had some big event. But to understand that these small moments of not getting your needs met, of feeling alone, feeling isolated, can cause a lot of scars and can take a toll on your psyche.
Do you go in that with guys that you work with, into those little nuances?
Not in a very structured way. So, you know, part of the work I do, we're not necessarily going back into the past and exploring trauma, unless it's actually coming up naturally in the coaching conversation. If it's something that's coming up, we'll explore it. But it's not something that I necessarily kind of say, okay, we have to get to the bottom. Where did this come from? What's your trauma? Unless it's something that the guy feels like, this is actually now a safe space for me to talk about it. I think that's, you know, the men's group that I run, the main purpose of it is just that it's a safe space where we can get together as guys and talk about things that we might not be able to talk about in other places. And so many times the most healing thing is when one guy is sharing something and you just see the nods of these other guys in the room who are kind of relating to this experience and feel like maybe they've been the only one who's dealing with that. But to hear other people talking about, oh yeah, I was teased, or, you know, I experienced this kind of incident in my life, or I'm having this trouble in my relationship and I don't know how to have this conversation. That's one of the most healing things for that shame. And, you know, just from a personal kind of my own story of recovery from porn addiction, I didn't actually do any kind of trauma work or kind of going into my past. It was much more focused on where am I today? You know, what are the patterns that I'm playing out? What are my subconscious default habit patterns of the mind? And how can I work with those to cultivate a healthier future? Having self-compassion, understanding, hey, there's a reason why I am the way I am. But I didn't necessarily have to go back into my childhood and say, oh, this happened to me when I was 3 and this happened to me when I was 5. I do think there's a time and a place for that, but it's not necessary all the time.
I agree. One hat doesn't fit everybody. When did you notice that porn addiction, when did you notice it was an addiction and that it was causing you harm? Because I think there's a difference between having a habit with people or when something starts to become damaging mentally, physically, emotionally, or externally.
Well, you know, which was interesting is I started getting into porn or pornographic sexualized content at a pretty young age, but I would say it's maybe par for the course. Maybe when I was 7, 8, 9 years old, I remember looking at comic book characters that kind of aroused a certain sensation within me. The Victoria's Secret catalogs that would come in the mail, the lingerie section of the catalogs. So I started at that young age and it just slowly progressed over time, over the course of many years, to the point where when I got to college and started getting access to the internet, that was when some of these tube sites started coming around where you could scan through hundreds or thousands of videos in any given night. And it got to the point where I was watching porn for maybe 1 or 2 hours on a daily basis. Every night, you know, I would go to bed and lock the door and log on and just be kind of browsing for 1 or 2 hours. And throughout that time, you know, it's this very interesting experience where if you do something every day since you're a kid, even if it grows over the course of those 10, 15 years, if it just grows to a small degree every single day, you don't notice that anything is changing. It's the same way if you've ever gotten fat over a period of time. You don't necessarily notice until you see a photo of yourself from a couple years ago and you realize, wow, I'm much bigger than I used to be. And so I didn't notice that anything was really wrong. I just thought this was normal. I thought, okay, this is, everybody does this. It was something I was ashamed of. So, you know, I would hide it and, you know, do it in privacy. But I didn't realize there was anything wrong with it until I had this wake-up call, this moment when I was finishing college. I'd stuck around to do a year of research. And I remember this day very distinctly. It was one of the most transformative days of my life. I was walking down the street, blue skies, sun was out, perfect weather. everything in my life was going amazing. I had a lot of friends. I was captain of the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu sports club. I had a lot of lovers. I was sociable. I knew how to interact with people. And I remember walking down the street and seeing these two attractive young women walking in front of me. And in that moment, I had this experience of just extreme lust kind of taking over my mind, this feeling of strong, intense craving and desire to be with them. It felt like a black hole had opened up inside of me. It was this emptiness, this void, this pit in my stomach that said, unless you have them, you won't be happy. And it was in that moment that I realized that this state of lust that had practically consumed most of my waking hours, it was a state of suffering. It was a state of emptiness, a state of lack, because I was looking at what I didn't have rather than all the things I was happy with. I realized a couple of things. One is I saw where that was leading me in the future, that if I didn't make a change, where I was headed was down this path. I was going to be some creepy 70-year-old dude hitting on girls at college bars. I saw that future very clearly for myself, and I realized that's not the future that I want. And I also had this realization, you know, it kind of struck me that my life is so amazing. Everything I put my mind to, I accomplish. You know, I want to do better in these classes. I get top scores in my classes. I want to get better at sports, become captain of a sports team. I want to, you know, date and pursue this woman, and I end up accomplishing that. But they never actually satisfy me. They never fulfill me. It's never enough. So I have this experience of just, it was almost an existential crisis, because I thought, will I ever be happy? You know, what is happiness? I had this real moment of just being curious about what is happiness and will I ever be happy? And that sent me down a big rabbit hole of, you know, getting into things like positive psychology. I found a book on Buddhist meditation. And there was that book that I found on Buddhist meditation totally changed my life, because I started to recognize what real happiness or real inner fulfillment was and what real suffering was. And I started to make the connections between porn and my suffering, porn and my lack of happiness in life. And there was this one quote that just blew my mind. It was a quote by a neuroscientist. It said, neurons that fire together, wire together. And what I realized is that every time I was logging onto a porn website, I was strengthening the neural pathways of lust and craving, of addiction, of wanting what I don't have. And I was the one creating my own suffering.
That's a very, very beautiful moment that a lot of people won't have the privilege of having. Just because on paper or externally, you may have material goods, great achievements, brilliant education, the ability to date whoever you want to date, that's not happiness. And it's almost like you have to go through it to understand it on a deep level.
Yeah, you have to experience the fulfillment of those dreams and desires and realize the emptiness inside of it to realize that it doesn't actually do anything. You know, there's this quote many people have heard that it's kind of an exercise mantra for marathon runners. They say, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional, right? You know, this idea that, okay, you might be experiencing pain, but whether or not you suffer from that pain is optional. It's how you relate to the pain. I decided to flip that on its head. And, you know, just in the same way that pain is not the same as suffering, pleasure is not the same as happiness. And this is, I think, something that's so fundamental that most of our society doesn't realize. We just think, if I have more sex, if I have more external validation, if I feel good and have more comfort, then I'll finally be happy. And it just doesn't work. I mean, it's just not a good strategy.
I went down the rabbit hole of like, what is happiness as well? And I read the books like, you know, The Monk Who Gives Away His Ferrari, and I started giving things away and then not having material things. And I went, for me personally, too far down a road of like wanting to live in a cave and wear sandals. But I needed to get there too to realize that's not it either. What I've learned through mindful practice and meditation is how my heart feels to what my head's saying. And what I mean by that is, like with a girl, for example, I'm married now and etc. But prior to that, I'd see someone, I'd be like, oh my God, she's the one. And I would play this film about us in the beach in California with the house, and then we'd get the dog, and then everyone sees me walk into a restaurant with this person, and that's it. But I could do it with 15 people on a tube or on a train or on a metro or walking down the street. And when I went into treatment, there was a wonderful therapist called Patty, Canadian girl. And she said to me, she saw me one day look at someone. She said, "Your butterfly's out today, isn't it?" And I said, "What do you mean by butterfly?" And she said, when people have strong lust for someone, in addiction, we call it your butterfly. She said, because that butterfly can land on me, on her, on them, on those. And it's just an addictive mindset process. So, you know, so I say to myself, "Oh, my butterfly's out today," because I can be attracted to anybody. Some days I'm not. But it's nice to sit back now and watch that and know that's just a butterfly. It's not me. Something's going on where I want to feel something, versus when I'm with my children, my heart's full and it's a different love. It's like a fulfilling moment rather than a thought process.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many beautiful little nuggets I want to pull on from what you said. One of which is just, you know, learning to not necessarily believe everything that your mind is telling you. You know, like the mind will say, "Oh, you know, she's the one." And our mind, if we don't pay attention to it, can tell us all these things. And it's not just lust. I mean, it's all of the things we get addicted to in society, like walking by the donut shop and seeing some donut, and the mind in this subconscious way says, "Ah, that donut, that'll make you happy. If you have that, you'll feel so good." And it's so funny because it's like we know on an objective level, it's like, no, if I look at this rationally, it's going to make me feel horrible. I'm going to feel crappy. I shouldn't eat it. But the mind is saying in signals to our body is kind of having this craving response, feeling that pleasure is going to be the solution. And so a lot of recovery is this mindfulness, this awareness of what are the stories that your mind is trying to trick you into. And it's our whole society that is promoting, buy this watch and you'll be well-liked, have this girl, wear these clothes, have this much money. And it takes a lot of work to pull back from that and put your hand on your heart and say, no, it's what's in here that's really important. These are the things that really fill me up.
It is, and it's a journey to get there. After the Buddhist book, I'm really interested in how did you find a silent retreat? What directed towards a silent retreat?
The silent retreats were the most transformative thing I've ever done in my life. And I ended up going on many of them after my first one. But how I found them, essentially, I found that first book on Buddhism. It was a book called Happiness by Matthieu Ricard. Phenomenal book. It was written by this guy who was from France, went to the Pasteur Institute. He has a background in molecular biology. So he has this background in science, but ended up becoming a Tibetan monk. And so he was able to really blend these two fields that were really important to me of neuroscience and, you know, a rational, pragmatic, non-fluffy approach to meditation with, you know, real ancient wisdom. So I started reading that book and then got into other books on Buddhist philosophy and realized a lot of Buddhist philosophy is really, it's a secular approach to addiction recovery, you know, that craving and clinging is the source of a lot of suffering. So Buddhism just really spoke to me, both due to my background in the sciences, the fact that I wasn't really into spirituality before that. So I started reading these books and had the great fortune, you know, it's one of the best things that ever happened to me, of deciding to take a year off between my undergrad and before I ended up going to grad school at Duke. I took a year off and ended up going to India for 3 months. And it was in India that I started traveling to these different monasteries, still reading books. And it was towards the end of my career when I landed in Dharamshala up in the north, where I started, you know, seeing these retreats. And these were kind of Buddhist retreats, and some of them were Vipassana retreats. And I ended up going first on a intro to Buddhism. You know, it was like a 9-day retreat that wasn't so much meditation. It was a bit more philosophy. And the next day, some of the people I was traveling with told me about this Vipassana retreat. this 10-day silent retreat where there's no talking, there's no reading, there's no writing, you're not making eye contact with the other participants. You're really just being in your own experience and practicing this meditation technique. And I went on that retreat and it was such a painful, torturous experience. It was really one of the hardest things I'd ever done because you're just sitting with the craziness of your own mind, sitting with your cravings and your aversions and annoyed at the person sitting next to you for breathing too loudly and feeling the pain in your back. You know, it's not like this experience of sitting down and being one with the universe. It's sitting down and like a crazy person is there with a megaphone shouting in your ear. But what is so profound about these retreats is you start to have little tastes of what real inner freedom is like, what real inner peace is like. When you've given up all your possessions, you have no distractions, and you're sitting there, you know, drinking a cup of tea, listening to the wind, and there are these moments of just profound stillness and contentment that make you realize that happiness, again, is not about these external things. It's about your relationship to what's happening. So that was one of the big insights that I was able to have, was realizing, oh, happiness is something inside of us that we can cultivate. And as you say, there's a middle path. It's not like we all need to go ordain and become monks in caves. You can still have a beautiful life in the world and enjoy pleasure. You can enjoy good food and enjoy sex and all these things. But it's about not being attached and not being addicted to needing these things for your happiness, but instead being able to enjoy it for what it is, which is an impermanent, passing, fleeting experience that you have the gift to enjoy if you're present for it.
It's so well said. I know that for me personally, that I love to be, you know, I live in a city, I like to be in the mix of things, but I also like to have those moments. And I also like to slow down. I can feel myself getting fast paced with the energy of a lot of people. But one of the practices I did before was to learn how to move mindfully so that I can move through a space and not get drawn into the energy or attached to that energy, but still be quiet, you know, separate. Not all the time. Sometimes I find people incredibly annoying, like you said, you know, especially personal space on the tube in London or walking around. But I know I have that capacity, that choice if I want to.
Yeah, the topic of the ability to choose is a really important one, I think, for addiction recovery. There's this beautiful quote, you probably heard it, you know, it's misattributed to Viktor Frankl. It's actually Stephen Covey kind of summarizing Viktor Frankl, but it's this quote, between stimulus and response, there's a space. And in that space is your power to choose your response. And in your response lies your growth and your freedom. And so much of this, you know, process of recovery is taking back your power to choose how to live, rather than just wandering around like this reactive monkey that, like, something, you know, someone yells at you and you yell back reactively, or you see something delicious and you just jump after it reactively. This ability to be calm and grounded and intentional with how you live, you know, all of our power and our freedom is in that ability, because otherwise we're just on autopilot acting out our habit patterns.
Was there a moment, how many retreats did you go to, Jeremy, before this started to embed itself in you? I know you had experiences, glimpses in the first one, but that's still new, isn't it, really, from you got degrees in genomics and genetics, and it's different, I think, journey into the body, right?
Yeah. I love that you bring in kind of the difference between learning about maybe the sciences or what we learn in school versus learning through the body. And in Buddhism, we call it experiential wisdom. It's like this wisdom that's known in the body. It's not knowledge, facts that you remember. In the same way that you, when you put your hand on a hot stove, your body feels that heat and instinctively pulls back. You know, you don't have to go through some logical, oh, this is hot, I should probably pull my hand off. The body has that instinctual experiential wisdom. And so that's what happens on these retreats, is slowly you build up the experiential wisdom of seeing impermanence, you know, seeing that things are fleeting and that you can't grasp on to pleasant experiences. You also get the experiential wisdom of contentment, real gratitude and stillness. In terms of how many it took before it started to actually imbue itself in me, I mean, it's an ongoing process. It's an unfolding, never ending. You know, at this point, I've gone on, I think, around 18 of these retreats over the last, whenever I started 15 years ago or so. And each time I go, it's just a good training for the mind. It's like going to the gym. You know, it's like you just have to keep having regular upkeep of keeping your mind healthy, cultivating the things you want to cultivate, letting go of unhealthy or unskillful habit patterns. My personal view, you know, there are a lot of people out there who practice Buddhism who have like enlightenment and full liberation on their goal sheet. And I don't think that's actually possible personally, but I don't think it needs to be possible, because every step you take along the path, every moment of mindfulness provides a little more freedom from compulsion.
With the guys you work with, do they mostly come to you for porn addiction or sexually related things? And anonymously, what's the most common habit that you see with these guys?
Most of the guys who come to, you know, work with me, join the group, are coming because of some relationship with porn addiction or sex addiction. Or it can also, it doesn't have to be a full-blown addiction. It can just be a kind of a compulsive or unhealthy or problematic relationship with these different behaviors. That being said, these are all on a spectrum. And when you have this addictive nature, it's not just going to be one slice that you do it in. It's going to bleed out into the way you live your life. And so for many of these guys, and this was myself included, porn addiction is just one small component. You know, we're also addicted to junk food or video games or people pleasing, being liked. There's so many different ways. It's like peeling back the onion. One of the things I like to also highlight for people is that porn addiction is rarely about someone's sexuality. It's a coping mechanism. It's a way to self-medicate. And it's usually a procrastination tool and just a way to numb out. And it usually doesn't even have to do so much with someone's sexuality. It just happened to be that that was the coping mechanism that they got hooked on when they were a kid. For some people, it's alcohol or cocaine or something else. But
what you just said is really important about numbing out. And most addictions are to cope with life, cope with situations, cope with feelings when you're overwhelmed. And I always say that people that have addictive problems are born with like less skin than everyone else because things affect them more.
Yeah. I mean, you nailed it. We're very sensitive, you know, those of us who have addiction. It's like we're very sensitive to experiences. When there's something painful, we really feel it. And because we feel it so strongly, we want to escape it. And I also think addicts are very smart. And one of the reasons they've developed an addiction is because historically throughout their life, they've learned how to manipulate their environment to get that feeling of escaping the pain or feeling pleasure. There's this beautiful, are you familiar with Gabor Mate?
Yes.
Yeah. He has this beautiful kind of saying where he's talking about addiction and he says, we shouldn't ask why the addiction, but why the pain. And then he says, the addiction is not your problem. The addiction is the attempt to solve the problem. And it's so much of this is just, it's us trying to address this underlying issue of feeling scared or anxious or bored or lonely or isolated or angry. And we're trying to self-soothe in an unhelpful way.
For me, my addiction was cocaine and other things, and I couldn't wait to get to use. Did you feel that pull when you was younger to have to get to your computer and have to get on there?
Yeah, it definitely. There was one moment I remember very clearly. I was on campus and I went into the library, pulled out my textbook. And again, just because my mind was so focused on checking people out, objectifying women, I kept staring at people that were walking by me, and I would, this fire of lust just built up so strong, this desire to have that release of orgasm, that I ended up having to leave after 10 minutes and I bicycled home and watched some porn. One of the really painful things about porn addiction is just the way that it controls your life. It causes you to not give your energy where it would be most rewarding and fulfilling, and instead to continue giving so much of your primal energy into something that is so empty and pointless and unfulfilling. One of the big pains for me is that just my mind was out of control. I was consumed by my lust rather than being, you know, having ownership of my actions.
It's almost like you can feel hijacked.
And that's exactly it. The amygdala hijack. I mean, on a neurological level, I mean, that's exactly what's happening is the amygdala, which is this fight or flight response of the brain. It's interesting. We've all heard of the fight, flight, or freeze, right? What's interesting is there's actually a fourth F there. It's the fight, flight, freeze, or fuck. And part of that amygdala response is also when there's something that you want. There's an opportunity and you get hijacked by this opportunity and think, I need to have that. Right. And what's interesting is there's this thing called the amygdala hijack. When you get triggered in this way, the amygdala will hijack the rest of the brain and it'll downregulate the prefrontal cortex, which is your rational decision-making part. And what's cool is that these mindfulness techniques, like they've shown that even just doing a labeling technique where you use a single word label to describe what emotion you're feeling, is enough to downregulate your amygdala and bring your prefrontal cortex back online. And this is how mindfulness can be so powerful for breaking free from that hijack and giving you back that ability to choose how to act, because it wakes you up from the trance of addiction. It wakes you up from the trance of being hijacked.
How do you tell your guys that you look after, what process do you put in place about once they've started to recognize patterns? What really works, or what worked for you for rewiring the brain to downsize the hijacking?
So a daily meditation practice of some sort can be extremely beneficial. What I mean by that is setting aside 2 minutes or 5 minutes or 10 minutes every morning at a regular time to practice some simple mindfulness exercises. And it's really important there that you're actually doing that mindfulness in a particular way, which is cultivating equanimity, a non-judgmental awareness of whatever's arising. A lot of people, this is one of the reasons I've created the online course that I did, is to really teach people about how to practice correctly so that you can get beneficial results from it. Because if you're practicing mindful breathing, and you're focusing on your breath, and every time your mind wanders off, you judge yourself and you say, oh, I'm such a piece of shit. I can't meditate. I'm so horrible at this. You're just strengthening more of that aversion. You're strengthening self-hatred and self-judgment. And so a really important thing to do is, as you practice any form of meditation, whatever's coming up, to see if you can make space for it, to let it be as it is. If it's unpleasant, let it be unpleasant without pushing it away. If it's pleasant, to let it be pleasant without grasping after it or thinking that you need to make it stay. That's another trap. People get in these ecstatic bliss traps with meditation. They have some ecstatic experience and they think, wow, transcendental joy and bliss, and I'm full of love. Ah, I love this feeling. Oh, I need to make it stay. Oh, how did I do my meditation? Let me make sure that happens. And then that creates its own suffering, right? Instead, as you meditate, it's like, let yourself be with what is as it's arising. That's a really important distinction there that I really hope people take away from this conversation, that it's not about the experience. It's about how you're relating to the experience. Are you attaching to a particular outcome, or are you cultivating the mental skill, the mental ability to let things be as they are, to let an unpleasant experience just be an unpleasant experience without needing to modify it or change it. You know, one of the phrases that really turned me on in Buddhism was this phrase, unconditional freedom, unconditional inner peace. And it's the idea is that your freedom can be unconditional. It's not based on the conditions of your life. Whether you have the supermodel in the Corvette or whether you don't, it's like, can you be filled with peace and integrity and contentment with both or with whatever's arising? And the balance there is, how do you live a beautiful life and still chase the things that you want and have ambitions and drives? And that's a whole nother conversation, but you can do both.
I love what you said about when you have blissful moments, that someone can get attached to them. So they'll bring a candle, has to be in the right thing. They wear the same clothes. The music has to be the same if they're using auditory. And it's another trap, like you said. I think you said it perfectly well. You can be trapped in that way as well, which would be the same as finding the right girl or boy or whatever in a relationship. This is the answer. Now I feel great. Well, you might do at the moment, but what happens if they run off with someone else or something happens to them or they tell you something?
If the conditions change.
It's the conditions, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, it's conditional happiness. It's like, oh, if I can get that girl or if I can have a peaceful meditation, then I'll be happy. And we put all of our happiness in these external things without realizing we can be happy in this moment, not based on those conditions.
Is there a type of porn addiction that people have more, or is it more of a lustful relationship that you're finding with the people that you're dealing with? Because I think, just to caveat that, globally, guys are kind of having a hard time at the moment having a voice. They are, especially over here. And there's lots of side behaviors that are coming out to cope with it. So what kind of porn or sex addictions are you finding with the guys that you work with?
It's a full spectrum. I mean, for so many men, and in part, it's because porn itself is a spectrum. And where's the line between hardcore internet porn versus an OnlyFans site versus a thirst trap on Instagram? A lot of times they just bleed into each other. And so guys will be on all of these different slippery slopes and acting out in different ways where they blend together. So there isn't really one particular thing. There are some disturbing recent trends in the world of porn addiction, of things around kind of AI video generation that can make some really disturbing content, and AI girlfriends and what that's doing for men and their ability to actually go out of their comfort zone and approach women in public and have a normal conversation. There's a lot of these topics of things that are going to get more challenging and more disturbing as technology progresses. But there isn't one particular flavor, and there's also not one particular type of personality or guy that has this. I mean, I work with CEOs and, you know, backpackers, and it's everyone. I mean, so many people are affected by this, and it is such a silent epidemic because of how taboo this topic is. For whatever reason, people get uncomfortable talking about porn, despite the fact that it has infiltrated its way into almost every device. Every, you know, child has seen it now. And it's getting worse and worse for the younger generation. Young boys and young girls are watching this and are learning about what they think healthy intimacy looks like from what's on the front page of Pornhub. So you're having all these stories of, you know, young men thinking that sex is all about choking and slapping and calling a girl bad names. And they think that's what real intimacy looks like. And girls are watching this too. So they're getting the message that this is what sex is and that's what they should be into. So there's so many rabbit holes we could go down with this topic, but it's an issue that affects a lot of men. And I guarantee so many of the men who are listening to this right now will have that experience of feeling like I have a problematic or maybe an unhealthy relationship with it and I don't know who to talk to about it.
What advice would you give, Jeremy, to, say, someone who's listening now that has an unhealthy addiction or habit to porn, or it's a go-to to relieve themselves literally from the day or for certain situations, if they have a confrontation or whatever, and that's their go-to? What was the first sort of steps that you'd recommend that they do to sort of take the lid off of what's going on?
It's a great question. I would say the first step for what someone should do if they're even just curious about whether or not their relationship with porn is unhealthy if they're not entirely sure, if they are sure, is to get connected to a community, a men's group, an online community around this. If you can't find a men's group or an online community, you know, finding a therapist or a coach or someone you can talk to who understands, but ideally a men's group where you can talk openly about this. And hopefully if it's a, not hopefully, you should make sure that it is a non-judgmental space, that it is not the type of space that shames people for watching porn or says it's evil and you're a bad person if you watch it, but a space that not normalizes it in the sense of condoning it, but helps you realize that you're not alone, that there are other people who struggle with this, and it's not your fault that you got addicted to this, but it is your responsibility. So that's what the benefit of a men's group can do, is it can help you feel safe to talk about something you've been ashamed of. And the other component of it is that you also have a space where people will call you up to your highest self and say, I know you're going through a lot, and I know you can do better, and I know you have so much potential, and I know living out of integrity is not how you want to live your life. So having that in a men's group is really powerful. So I would say the first thing is to get connected somehow. Or if you can't get connected, start listening to podcasts like this or reading books. The more that you can realize you're not alone and you're not, you know, a freak, you're not perverted, you're not broken. This is the healing, the toxic shame. The more you can do that, the stronger your foundation for recovery is going to be. As you say, you know, when you get stuck in this shame, this isolation, it makes you want to run away. And that just exacerbates the addiction. And it makes things come out sideways and makes you, you know, boil over with anger and frustration.
Thank you, Jeremy. This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scholfort and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up and you can get in touch with us, because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Eber Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Ria Musa and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholfort. Hi, everybody. I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys.